Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. This episode is a 10-page podcast all about one of his short stories. Get ready to enjoy our remarks.
Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who loves duck comics, who loves Christmas, and I'll say I love getting my comic books at the tire store because who doesn't? We have a pretty cool cool holiday episode here, and I've got a great returning guest rejoining me for the first time in a while. Thad, welcome back to you. Who are you?
Howdy, I'm Thad Komorowski. I am an animation historian and film restoration artist, and also a Disney Comics localizer. That means I take a lot of those wonderful Italian, Dutch, and what have you stories from all over the world and give them a fresh and modern take in the localization. And I love every second of it. It's a lot of fun doing this. And of course, one of my main muses, as I've always said on the show, is the work of Carl Barks.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is really cool, right? Because we get to talk about some Barks from a really interesting era. How do you feel about your 1940s Carl Barks?
Oh, gosh. I love all Barks. I have a fondness for the 40s Barks. I don't know if I've talked about 40s ducks. I've talked about 40s mice when we did Riddle of the Red Hat with Debbie. Right. But 40s Barks, he really hit his stride in the mid 40s, I think. And there's some really wonderful long-neck cynical duck stories in that era. And, he came into his own really around 48. But I have a very soft spot for the immediate post-war era of Barks. And a lot of these exemplify it. Some more than others.
Yeah, this should be a lot of fun. Hey, I really appreciate you joining me. You know, you mentioned you're up to a lot of animation projects. See you sharing about some of the cool stuff that you get up to with restoration. You do a lot of commentary. Folks have seen you if they've got those Fantagraphics collections. You show up providing some great commentary on those and the localizing and everything. I noticed your name on a couple covers of, I think, would that have been Boom era? No,
IDW. Right after the Boom. IDW. That was a weird time because it was it was very unorthodox, but to see the translator or localizer credited on the cover, but David Gerstein, the patron saint of Disney comics in English and maybe worldwide, he pushed for that, and I'm pretty grateful.
Yeah, that's got to be a real treat. That's great because, we don't, like you say, you don't always credit the localizer that way. But it's important when you're bringing an Italian comic over to America or vice versa. And yeah, David Gerstein, I know you're going to have some stuff to say about.
Yes.
He had a little bit of a personal touch on some of the ones we're going to talk
about.
Yes,
he did. He helped rescue he rescued at least two of these stories. Yes.
Yeah. So these stories, we got a pretty packed agenda here where I guess we have 50 pages of comics total. It's an ambitious one. So I'll tell you, listener, we're not going to go into quite the detail with most of these, but we're doing something really special here. I got to do one other episode like this early on where I talked about some of Barks, what I viewed as some of his best from that early era of the 40s. I kind of hung the hat of that episode on the Duck in the Iron Pants for obvious reasons. And I paired it with some that weren't quite as good as that one, but still really excellent. But we're going to be doing the same thing. I didn't think I'd come back to the 40s, but this is just too good of an episode hook here, Thad. I joked about getting your comics from the tire store. but the reason is because what we're doing today is we are covering the five what are called Firestone giveaway. What do you know about these, Thad?
Just that at one time during the Christmas season, you could get your kids a Disney comic book from the tire store And yeah, that's not really shocking, because that's always been the goal of the Disney name, is to be so ingrained into culture. It's not a new thing like some try to purport it to be. No, Walt Disney was very, very, very much wanted to have his characters, you know, everywhere. So this is not an exception. It, even though that these stories were produced by Western Publishing, wow, it there's a reason why nobody knows about, you know, the Bugs or the Woody or the, you know, whoever else giveaways as much.
Right. Yeah. Walt was a storyteller, but he was really a marketer. So you're right. It totally makes sense. It really cracks me up. I remember when I first heard about these, like Firestone giveaway, that kind of rolls off the tongue. That's neat. Surely it doesn't have any. It is the tire store. Okay. It just amuses me. It kind of makes sense. You're going to drag your kid along while you get a set of tires, give them something to do. So, you know, Barks had a pretty good run of these five 8-page stories in 5 of those comics over 5 years. That's pretty neat. But I don't want to be remiss. I don't want to leave out the other story that we're talking about, because really it is the main attraction. We're going to be talking about Silent Night as kind of our headlines. And Thad, I got to thank you for suggesting this one to me, because it had gone under the radar for me, and I am just experiencing it for the first time. And we were talking, this has got to be the best Bark story that I had never previously read. So very excited.
Well, it's always a joy when that happens. There's an artist or a series that you think you've seen everything, but no, you actually haven't. And you find this gem that you completely forgot about. I just always hope for that. But when you're as obsessive as we sometimes get, we might not have that.
Yeah, exactly. It really is a thrill. Just sends a little chill when you discover something. All right. So like I said, that it's a lot of pages to cover. We're going to be kind of businesslike about this. Instead of doing the like page by page narrative action of each of these, I'm going to give like a little capsule summary for the Firestone stories. And then we're going to, you know, just share our thoughts, our impressions. Thad, what I'm really interested in for these is kind of what these stories say about Christmas in the late 1940s in the United States. You know, it's a crazy time, right? We're just at the end of the Second World War. We're just ramping up into a kind of a different idea of what it means to be an American and to kind of live in the kind of consumer oriented society that we are. So that's part of what animates me. Part of what animates me of course, Barks storytelling and kind of how he tackled these Christmas stories that were, I mean, it's an assignment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of these were just him collecting a check. It's really obvious. With one exception, these are not top tier Barks. They do have a lot of elements of his other Christmas stories. Even in a giveaway at a tire store, he's still making commentary about the commercialism of Christmas. That's been covered very, very heavily, I'm sure, on your podcast and a lot of different commentaries. I'm looking at all 5 of them right now. I did reread them before the podcast, and yeah, there's definitely a skew towards, you know, kids get gifts at Christmas. That's very much the running theme, and it's not quite as cynical in most cases, but there's a germ of it.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there, right? That this is kind of that like nascent consumerism. There's a hint of the cynicism. There's definitely an element of Christmas is for kids. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's do it. Let's get in here. All right. So Thad, first up, we've got Best Christmas. Mm-hmm. And this came out in This came out in Firestone giveaway number 45 in December of 1945. Are they numbering them based on?
They're not numbered. They're not. Well, yeah, it just means the 1905.
Right. So we're talking about the 45 edition. Yeah, because there weren't even nearly that many. This was a Disney Firestone collab, mashup, whatever. All right. So I guess it's proper to say best, Firestone giveaway 1945. And basically this story is the Ducks having this like very old fashioned, and I think it's meant to be old fashioned even in its day, right? A very traditional Christmas. The plan is that it's a very simple. The plan here is that they're going to go on a sleigh ride to Grandma Duck's farm. They are just going to encounter some of the typical obstacles that you're going to get once you put Donald Duck in front of a goal, right? Mm-hmm. Some things are going to go terribly wrong. Some of them are going to be weather related. Some of them are going to be traffic related. The whole way, Donald is going to be really goal-minded about wanting to have the best Christmas ever. And ultimately, it's going to seem like it ends up pretty terribly as he crashes through some ice, nearly gets hypothermia, and they have to take refuge in, our little message moment of this story.
Yes, of course, there's that.
Yeah, where the Ducks are going to encounter an example of real poverty, some kids who are not having the best Christmas. And they're going to make the decision to give away their Christmas unbeknownst to Donald and en route to. And at that point in their journey, Donald, kind of quietly turns home because they don't have their Christmas eats and their Christmas cheer. And he is, in fact, proud of them. But all turns out well as they get back to their house and they find that Grandma Duck, a pretty striking version of Grandma Duck.
Yes, I think this is the first time Barks drew that. I'm not positive. I think it is.
Yeah,
the real grandma shows up in... what is that story where the kids are trying to play chord? I think that's the first grandma as we know her. But of course, Altalia Farrow came up with the character and designed her. But I mean, Barks just drew an old duck and that's in this story. So and just called it grandma. So
right. She is a generic grandma duck, not grandma.
Right.
And so it ends up well because she has brought them all the Christmas eats and cheer and joy. So, that's it. There's a lot of fun moments, I would say, in this one, Thad. What struck you about this story?
It's definitely, it's kind of in the we're kind of at the point where Barks is coming into his own as a comic storyteller, because there's a lot of echoes of the older stories where his roots in animated short filmmaking are very much at play. A lot of gags, a lot of sight gags. And there's also a little bit of the sappiness, the hard lesson of like who has it harder. In wartime and post-war America, that was very common. There's some echoes of that $10 dither story right here. The kids do the right thing and give the stuff to the needy. I mean, it is what it is. It's, I think I would be thrilled as a little kid to get a story like this. In a giveaway. So, he did his job very well. And I just have to say, I'm very grateful that there are no Firestone tie-ins with this story. Like they got the sled, they get saved because, grandma's car with Firestone tires comes in or something. I'm sure if Barks was told to do something like that, he's like, yeah, why don't you see what Paul Murray's doing? Get him to do this.
We get plenty of that kind of advertorial in the 19 like late 50s and 60s, but I guess the companies were a little bit less brazen about it at this point. I think you're right. This is like a perfectly serviceable. This would be great to get while I'm waiting for my dad to get a new set of ridge walls or or whatever. I will say I feel like there's one standout sequence. I love the hay cart and, yes, and the rider. Yes. He's just so stoic and so placid. Yes. As he, like, you know, Donald beans him with. I'm going to call that my panel of this story, and feel free if you want to point one out, sure, too, is the one where he's taking a big wind up and he's saying, my only regret is that this isn't a hand grenade.
Oh boy.
And he just beans the guy. And then the guy just placidly, you know, rolls him up in a ball. Mm-hmm. That guy wins this.
Yes, that's classic Barks. Just doing the, you know, very much the stone face, Buster Keaton, Ned Sparks type of character, just going through the motions, completely expressionless. Yes, you did single out the best part of the story. Yes. And as we said, it, nothing huge, but, you know, it's nice enough.
Yeah. My other pick for panel of it is where that stone face guy says, there, that'll cool you off.
Yes.
Which I just, so, you know, not too much to say about this one. I assume we got our fill on. I will note, as we wrap up each of these, I'll just check in on the index response to them. You know, I like to check in index. People can rate these stories in addition to kind of find facts and information, mm-hmm, about them. Thad, this one's got a pretty low rating for a Bark story. It's number 2,801 on index. You know, and there's like, what, 43,000 stories, right, or so, I think, that are rated. But that is strikingly low for Barks, and I'll say it. This is not that bad of a thing.
Right.
I think that's a little bit.
Is there any Barks story that's rated under 7 on the site? Because I kind of think that's like voters cut off. It's like, well, you know, any lower and you're getting close to, I don't think Barks was capable of that.
you pretty much nailed it. If there is a story that is lower, it's a result of review bombing. I don't know if it's still there, but if you look up, what's it called? Interplanetary Postman.
Really?
You can tell mathematically that someone has, like, engaged in a systematic review bombing of it. Because, like, it's a weird, and it's definitely one of his worst and loopiest stories. Yeah. But it's nowhere near as bad as the, like, someone engineered it. I'm curious now to see if it's still like that. Because it always cracks me up. Anyway. All right. So yeah, we're on to Santa's Stormy Visit is the next one chronologically.
Yeah, this is my favorite of the Firestone giveaways. It's clearly just, you know, it's not a 10 pager, but it could have. It's just a really fun story with a little bit of a sense of adventure with the lighthouse setting. It's got a really great character in the was it the seagull or an albatross? Albatross, that's right. I know my favorite story. Don't tell me. It's the albatross. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But and this one, for those that might not know, this one had a long history pre-90s where they didn't know where the proofs for the story was. And we have, I asked the aforementioned David Gerstein about its history, and I'm just going to relay a little bit of what he wrote. He wrote me quite a lot, but I'm going to keep it relevant to Santa's Stormy Visit.
And yeah, we love to hear, even if it's secondhand, we love to hear from David Gerstein.
So here we go. Okay, let's see. You can tell Mark I said hi. Hi from David, Mark. And also, missing proofs were usually the result of publishers not communicating as well before the internet age. Gladstone and Disney's U.S. publishing office didn't have a good connection, and Egmont didn't know what in its vaults was rare. The big missing stories for a number of years were Santa's Stormy Visit, Race to the South, Race to the South Seas, Darkest Africa, Donald Duck Tells About Kites, and Two Pages of the Terrible Turkey. And in the original Another Rainbow Carl Barks Library, all of these were traced versions, either made by the Dutch or by Gladstone themselves, which is why if you have those wonderful books, if you have those wonderful library sets, those look a little funky. But it was in 1993, Egmont found a better original but somewhat muddy Santa Stormy Visit in their vaults, and it was used for the Carl Barks Library Color album that Gladstone put out. But later in 1998, I, and this is David talking, found a better, sharper one there myself, and this was what we used for the later Gemstone printing and more recently at Fantagraphics. So yes, once again, another piece of Disney Comics history was saved by David Gerstein. And I have to say, I'm grateful. This is when I talk about peak 40s Barks, this is on the edge of it, because he's figured out a lot of things that a comic book storyteller has to do.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, I share your opinion that this is the strongest of them. I mean, I think it really does have the structure, like you said, of one of his classic 10-pagers. Again, great thanks to David Gerstein. Every fan, whether they know who he is or not, should be grateful to him just for all of the, like, general advocacy. And, you know, I know that he just almost eats and breathes this stuff. So
yes. Well, I always say if it's a Disney comic in English and David Gerstein's name is nowhere in the credits, you probably should skip it.
Right. I gotta tell you, Thad, like when I first started to do this podcast and I started to get I kind of retroactively tried to insert myself into the Disney comics community, you know. I didn't know who was who. And David, like, just kind of reached out to me, just like to fill me in on a lot of really interesting stuff. I had no idea who he was. I like looked him up after he started telling me all this really fascinating and interesting stuff and realized, oh, that's who this guy is. He really knows what he's talking about. And he was involved in a lot of the stuff that I enjoyed. It was a neat little, like, you know, moment of it clicking me.
So, oh, absolutely. He's wonderfully generous like that. Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. So that's also, I think, why this was another treat for me, because I was reading the Gemstone stories at the time, but I didn't get this. Like, I missed this one. I was kind of falling out of getting the comics because I had acquired the Vast. Mm-hmm. So this was another one that was new to me, and it was just a total delight. Really enjoyed reading this. As you say, the lighthouse scene, the lighthouse setting is awesome. The ducks are lighthouse keeper. The story, it's called out that it's right before Christmas Eve, and the nephews are, you know, really engaged, as kids are, in getting to enjoy Christmas. And the ducks are also very fastidiously, like, polishing this lighthouse to keep these ships safe. And there's just a little bit of kind of back and forth about how are they going to get word out. They're going to send a letter to Santa and to detail what they want. And that's fortunate for Donald, who has kind of whiffed getting them stuff ahead of time. So, you know, he figures if he can, quote, deliver their letter, that's a good idea to get them what they want. And in the meantime, things are going to go wildly wrong because of an albatross. Thad, do you know the deal, like, from a literary point of view, what the deal is with albatrosses?
I know it's a very common turn of phrase when you say it was like albatross, you know, something's absolutely lifted right off of you. And as Barks is able to show, it can be very comical and do a lot of damage.
Yeah, it's just a funny bird. They were like, there was one in the rhyme of the mariner.
Yes.
And sailors believe, you know, bad luck. It's that's kind of what I was thinking about.
Gotcha.
But anyway, they end up that they take in this albatross. And I love this animal character, right? He is an animal, but he's an animal character. And, you know, there are some just really wonderful moments where Donald sees the silhouette of the albatross warming itself on the lighthouse light. And he's going to this effort to, like, remove it until finally he's like, oh, I'll just take it inside. He can stay warm in here. But then when there's a hurricane and he's going to need to signal with the radio, the albatross, the world's strongest albatross, I guess, smashes the radio up, which is going to prevent him from relaying his nephew's order, you know, in the face of the hurricane. And ultimately we get this, it's a little bit convoluted, but it's a cute, like, play on a Christmas miracle, right? The nephews end up sending a message attached to the albatross in the hopes that Santa will get it. And they have that childlike faith in Santa Claus. It's a hallmark of these Christmas stories. And he ends up blundering the albatross onto a ship. And the ship ends fulfilling their Christmas order, but doing it in secret and letting Santa claim the presents.
I like this little twist. It sounds corny to use like the word magical, but I think this one's more sincere than the other stories. It's just like, you know, just a series of events, and, you know, they all intersect into each other. And, you know, it's not like, you know, like some of this other stuff that we're about to read. It's not sappy in that way. It's funny because the captain, I think that might be my line of the story, wants to feed him to the third class passengers or something when he first sees the truck. That's great.
Yeah, that's a great choice for the panel. I think you're right. You know, I figured based on the title of this one, having not read it before, that we were going to see Santa himself. Right. Mm-hmm. In this stormy visit, because that's what I was familiar with the other four Firestone tales. And I know that at least one of them is not above having the real Santa Claus. Cool. So I like that this was like it was a quote miracle, but it was something that was at least in the realm of plausibility and just a nice turn.
It calls to mind he did a much later story. I'm forgetting what the title of it is. It's from 54 55, the one with them and Scrooge in the submarine, kind of. It has echoes of that as well.
Yep, Submarine Santa. I've got there. That one in the bank as probably my last Christmas podcast for next year.
Oh, cool.
I think this one's a much stronger story, although I like that one. Mm-hmm. I was shocked at how much I like this. You know, you've got Barks loves to draw seascapes and stormy. So he gets to be in his element here. The albatross is just a hoot. Like looking at him cracks me up. And I'll tell you, I think that Van Horn must have, used this as a model for his albatross in the story that he collaborated with Barks on, that he did the art for.
Absolutely.
So that was a neat thing to like recognize, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really dug this one. I thought this was great. I like when Donald calls out the 249 steps. I think for me, the panel has got to be a couple of panels where the albatross is warming his haunches on that lighthouse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So let's see. Any other comments before we wrap it up by checking in on Index?
Well, you know, if I would have been overjoyed to have any of these stories as a kid, I would have been absolutely thrilled to see this one, because it's just as funny as any of the 10 pagers at the time.
I was gonna kind of save it for the wrap up, but this one kind of stands head and shoulders above the other ones. That this is like definitely the winner of the five. Index has this one with a respectable rating of number 975. I think it deserves to be higher. I think this is a really really good story.
It is. Okay.
All right. So let's keep moving on. We are next up to 1947. Of course, these are all around the holiday season, December. We've got Three Good Little Ducks. This is a classic, like, misbehaving nephew's story, right? I think, you know what, Thad? I feel weird saying it, but I think this is my least favorite of these, even though there are a couple after this that are a lot kitschier.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm kind of over this story type.
You've seen it. This just has the feeling of I've seen this before, you know, and it's not like, you know, there's a refreshing take on it, you know, as Barks would often do when he would revisit material. And he probably would have, you know, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but, you know, there's probably another 10-pager with similar aspects that was done a thousand times better.
Yeah, absolutely. That,
like, it's calling to mind a lot of the New Year's stories, like a couple of the New Year's resolution stories. Like, they even, he just did that Tames His Temper story that's kind of very similar to this. Well, not really, not that similar, but thematically it's similar. But then there's the later, there's a couple of later ones too, like another 8 or 9 years later where he did the resolution stories. And
right.
This is, you know, just a try fail because, you know, Huey, Dewey, and Louie are such jerks the rest of the year. They actually forget about what they've done to mess with Donald. So, I mean, as I said with the other one, you know, I would have been just thrilled to have this as a kid, but that's what all it is. It's a filler story.
It is. I think some of the measure of how hackneyed it is mm-hmm. how easy it is to summarize, right? Yeah. They're trying to make good on their past misbehavior from over the year, as you said. So they're like Christmas Eve, they're trying to butter Donald up and things just go disastrously wrong. You mentioned that they're like accidentally bringing out some of their old pranks from over the year. And they just ruin things so much that they feel like they have to skulk off with the classic tramp Bindle. That was fun to see.
Yeah.
And you know, hide out under the bridge like hobos. Meanwhile, Donald, of course, has already gotten them a lavish Christmas because Christmas is for kids and welcomes them back, making them promise just not to try to butter him up. That's it.
Yep.
So it's fine. You know, it's all right. But I have seen so much of it. There are a few fun moments. You know, I really like all the little poses of the nephews on the first page, slumped over and stressing about their endangered Christmas.
You can definitely see the common Barks Christmas theme of greed, because that's what drives the story. I mean, they're not,
right.
this is not them having a real change of heart. They want toys for Christmas. So
yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Christmas is for kids, and it's for kids who are greedy, who want things, which, you know, it's kind of the default state of being a kid. Mm-hmm. I will note that, you know, this story and the other they are a good example of like a Barks storytelling convention, right? Any of these nephews stories that, you know, they're really the star of the story. It's not a dumb story. He has such a great tailor-made device. We see, you know, 1, 2, 3, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. We see the first kid do something, the second kid has a variation on, and then the third kid. So in this case, each of them are going to bring something to Donald that results in, you know, it's like a resurfaced old prank. So it's neat how he, I find that kind of storytelling very reassuring, you know, because it gives the story a nice structure. Let's see, any other comments? Oh, I did like the little, he adorned one of the panels with like Father Time sliding, sliding down a slope saying time slides by. I really liked that. I found it funny that Donald apparently ties his car to his garage and a nephew, you know, tries to drive it away and tears down the garage. That's pretty funny that the nephew just is like, all right, I'm going to drive. but yeah, it sounds like we've said what we have to say about Three Good Little Ducks. And then Indux. So, you know, this is where I'm a little bit out of step with Indux, I guess. They have this one clocking in right now at number 830. You know, like not a strong rating, but better, for example, than Santa's Stormy Visit, which I thought had a lot to say for it.
Yeah, this is very strange.
You know, and it's not the be all end all, of course, but Indux is probably the best measure that we, you know, have to, if we want to be scientific about these stories and what people, quote, the community thinks. All right. So Thad, we're on to one of the most interesting stories, I think, to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably technically worse than Three Good Little Ducks, but but it's just so weird. It's and you don't need it's obvious to anyone that Karl Barks did not come up with this story.
Right. Yeah, you're right. This, we're talking about Toyland, and it certainly is, like, from a technical standpoint, probably the worst of the stories, but it's so interesting to me, right? Because he, you know, if you look into the background of this, yes, he was given this script, but he was given the opportunity to, like, script doctor it, right? He did a rewrite, and that stands out. I think you can tell. I feel like he whipped this into something pretty serviceable.
Right.
Again, the summary is not going to take very long, and it's bonkers. It just matter of factly has Santa Claus himself, the real Santa, inviting Donald and his nephews to the North Pole so that they can test out the toys and give them their feedback on, you know, which toys are the most fun, the most enjoyable. And you know, Donald is supposed to be kind of taking down their notes, and he does throughout the story. And basically it's an excuse to watch the nephews engage with these toys, and for Donald to have some kind of disaster befall him with the kids while the kids are playing with the toys. You know, he'll have a pogo stick mishap, a skiing mishap, and so on and so forth. And ultimately it ends with Santa asking them for their report, and them, you know, not really being able to say, because they've just been having so much fun with all of them, and Donald himself was distracted with all of them. So to me, this is kind of like an old person's lament at the end, where an older person is reassuring themselves that kids still love the classic toys, and there will always be a place.
I have not much to say about this. I agree with you that it's fascinating. I mean, it's that there's still any semblance of Barksisms in this, because it's such a ludicrous premise of Santa Claus bringing Donald and the boys up there to the North Pole. The only thing that stands out in my mind, the winning panel, is the last one. That burly neighbor riding his kid's little bicycle. While the kid watches tearfully, and he's making comments on Donald being nuts and playing with his kids' toys.
Yeah, that is a great one, with that, like, proto neighbor Jones. I do like the opener where he's reading Santa's telegram, and there's a telegram delivery guy kind of casually waiting there. I think I would note that Barks, I see his structure in the story where he is carrying around a writing pad, and he keeps saying, when the nephews have some kind of comment on the toys, he says, "I'll make a note of that." And it's a simple thing, but that repeated element definitely, like, strengthens the story. You know, there's a couple of, like, gag beats where he's able to kind of do a different play on it, saying, you know, when he gets chased by a polar bear on the skis, saying, "I've jotted that down with capital letters, boys, with capital letters." So, you know, I thought that was cute. And just a lot of the character art in this, Thad, is actually, like, really great.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's when he really became peak Barks. It's in, because he did the story in July 48. I mean, it was published in December, but I'm just looking at the index. And yeah, that's when his art just clicks like that. So
yeah, it is masterful. I'm not going to name any names, but I'm trying to imagine this story drawn by a contemporary of his.
It would lose any readability it has. Let's put it that way. If it went over to anyone else, I mean, he took this very corny premise and turned it in. You know, it's, you know, of course, no one's saying that this is a classic, but you know, he did the best he could with it. You know, and I think he would have not done it if Santa was giving away Firestone tires at the end. No, right. That would be for Murray or Harvey Eisenberg. So
yeah. So you know, Toyland, a very interesting piece of ephemera, and a good example of how Barks. This is like the thing that you phone in. You know, if ever there was a thing that you phone in, and he really wrung some pretty entertaining stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
Checking on Index, it does get that like bare bones 7 out of 10, but we are down, really far down. This has got to be one of his lowest rated stories at 7,504. Which I'll say it, you know, it's not a good story, but it's,
I mean,
not,
it makes sense.
That bad.
I
think it's just rubbing people the wrong way. You know,
yeah.
it's that weird. All right. So we are on to our last of these stories in December of 1949. We had New Toys. All right. So New Toys, again, this one has kind of that built-in structure I was talking mm-hmm. about. This is the other where each nephew is going to do something in turn. We have the nephews kind of in advance of Christmas pining for new toys. But weirdly, they just want the newest edition of toys they already have, right? So they've put on their wish list, what, a scooter, a wagon, and a bike, a coaster wagon, a tricycle, and a scooter, rather. And there's this debate whether they should ask their uncle or ask Santa Claus, which we've seen in a couple of other Barks Christmas stories.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Donald refuses while they have some use left in those toys. So they're going to resort to trying to earn some money to buy them themselves, delivering telegrams and so forth. And it's going to be using those toys, and something, of course, is going to go disastrously wrong, resulting in the toy getting destroyed in some way. And, you know, the bright side, of course, is that now they can get their new toys, because that's what Donald has said. But, you know, meanwhile, Donald is kind of giving into the Thad, I've got kids, I feel this, the reflex of, oh, Christmas comes but once a year, and Christmas is for kids. And so, you know, there's the tendency to like get them too much crap, because Donald is just going to get the things that they wanted anyway. And they don't even have to show him their destroyed ones. So, you know, by Christmas, they get to loudly enjoy their new versions of the old toys. But of course, who should they ride and canter past? But another example mm-hmm. of some deep poverty, some very mm-hmm. unfortunate kids without toys. Thad, do I even need to say what they're going to do?
Do they give those toys to the kids? I don't know.
You won't be shocked. That's exactly what they do, because that's what kids do in Christmas specials and almost no other time. And, you know, Donald, in the meantime, has gotten a very nice gift from, I think it's from Daisy, right?
Yes.
She gave him a really awesome and almost certainly the equivalent of $2,000 or $3,000, I would say, at least,
yeah,
in modern, a tool set. And so, you know, they give their toys away without telling Donald the old ones have been destroyed. And Donald catches them using his deluxe new tool set, and he celebrates their generosity. You know, I liked seeing it was funny seeing the kids just using power tools casually. Yes. Here. What do you think? Your thoughts on this one?
It is what it is. It's a serviceable story from his peak period. You know, it's like we said, it's revisiting a lot of similar themes, though not quite as, you know, just not quite as in the same way, because the kids are at least trying to get their own, you know, they're not trying to get Santa to do it or really to get Donald to do it. So, you know, they're trying to do their own thing. So it's interesting in that respect. And, you know, I think the whole sappiness of the orphan or the down on their luck poverty kids, that's just him with his own view of the cynicism of the holiday. It's like, hey, if you got enough to give, give it. And that's about the biggest lesson you can take from these stories. And it's something he does repeatedly. And
you know, becomes the epitome, of course, is Christmas for Shacktown. So that's sort of, you know, where this was leading.
Yeah, this does kind of feel like a little bit of a dry run almost for Shacktown.
Mm-hmm.
It's always interesting to see his take on poverty, you know, since he has like his most famous character is such a tycoon capitalist. So, you know, checking in on Index for New Toys, that one ranks at 1,312. You know, no great shakes. That feels about right to me. It's fairly unremarkable, but not as bad as Toyland as far as these things go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this one's not too interesting. It's a perfectly fine, serviceable story, again, for what it is, you know, this free giveaway. All of these 8-page stories, I think, you know, if I wanted to kind of wrap them up into a bow, I would say they're all well worth the price of admission. I'm not damning them with faint praise. You know, they're free comics. They're really good. For free comics, they're all very entertaining.
Oh yeah.
Obviously Toyland is weird.
Yes.
That's the only one that gets a little bit into the hokey Christmas magic, and that wasn't even his brainchild. So it's interesting where Bark's, you know, interest lies. He still wants to tell these human stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's what makes them stand out. I mean, David bless him, he does try to reprint the other giveaway stories. But, you know, the ones that everyone wants to keep going back to, if they do, are the Barks ones, because he always put that much more thought into it, because, you know, they're not paying for these stories. So, but he's still the professional he always is. And he puts in all the effort that you'd want him to in most cases.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had 5 years spanning the end of war, post-war, just really, really interesting little look of life in that era and the importance of the holiday, right? It was a big seller every year, or a big draw. They're not selling these, obviously, but, you know, this is what got people to come into your, it puts butts in seats or people in tire stores.
Yes.
All right. So that was great, Thad. We're going to kind of transition here now to our main attraction, right?
Yes.
And we are in this same era, right? Because we've been in 45 through 49, and Silent Night was intended to come out in early 1946. Do you want to kind of set the table a little bit for this one, Thad?
Yeah. So this is officially the very first Carl Barks story that was completely censored. This was supposed to be for Walt Disney's Comics and Stories number 64. He submitted it in August 45, and his editor said that this was too violent a story for Christmas. And, you know, that's it is a very violent story. That does not mean it's not very funny, which it is. And as all the writers have noted, Barks sort of remade the story as The Terrible Tourist in 1960. And it did see publication in 1982 in the fine art of Walt Disney's Donald Duck. But by that time, the first half page was lost. But Barks had preserved the rest, and collectors had made photostats. And that's where it stood until much more recently in this century. There was a newly produced version of that missing half page. So to set the tone a little bit, I will read some of, once again, we have David Gerstein to thank for this, because he helped commission and recreate that half page. So here's David's notes. Barks himself recalled to Rob Klein, and Donald Ault, the late of Donald Ault, confirmed it, that the story opened with a long shot of Donald's house, and that when we first saw Donald inside, he'd just finished reading a book. And in the fifth panel, the first surviving Barks panel, Donald's dreamy reverie starts with, "This should be the season." This wording implies a comeback put down of an earlier claim from someone else that this is the season for or to do this, and a claim that Donald objects to. Being Donald, I'd suspect that he first objected harshly, then drifted as he explained himself. Donald ends the page by suddenly acting angry at the kids to the point of giving them a dictatorial command. I don't think even Donald would get this stern for no reason at all. Thus, I suspect that the kids must have made the initial claim of this is the season to do this, the claim that initially set Donald off. So what of it? The kids have to begin the story doing something objectionable, and when called on the carpet for it by Donald, they make an excuse that takes the form of, "But Uncle Donald, this is the season to do what we're doing." Whereupon Donald goes through these three reactions: initial outrage at the nephew's perceived nerve to say what they have said, dreamy rambling as he gets lost in his romantic thoughts, and then a final stern return to the initial outraged attitude. And that is how much thought David puts into his work. So this was a very, well thought out recreation when you didn't really have much to go on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he makes the case very convincingly here. And the recreation, I think, flows very seamlessly.
Yes.
Because otherwise it does start just very abruptly, right? Mm-hmm. You know, which makes sense with the missing.
Right.
Boy, Thad, you mentioned that like this one was spiked by the editors for,
yes,
for being too violent. And of course, you hate to see it, right? But you kind of, at least I kind of understand it.
I got it a little bit. And I think it was the juxtaposition with the song Silent Night.
Right.
That might have put the kibosh on this.
Yeah.
Because I was talking with a few people because like I was like, well, wait, does he mention Jesus or Mary at all? And there is one mention in the story. And
mother and child, I guess.
Yes, virgin mother and child, yes.
So there is that little element of sacrilege, right? Like,
right.
Silent Night is a hymn, but it's such an institution. It's almost a secular song, but it's not too, right? Like it is both. And you're not used to overt call outs to Christianity in Disney comics.
No.
But it's so important that the song be Silent Night, right? I saw that there were some notes, right, that the editors were initially pondering maybe changing the lyrics to, was it Deck the Halls?
I'm not sure about that, but it would not work.
It said Deck the Halls. They initially were going to change the lyrics to be Deck the Halls, probably for the sacrilegious element, but that doesn't work because of the irony of the Silent Night. I told you that this was my first experience with this mm-hmm. story, and what a blast. This is a riot.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yes. This is Barks shedding a little bit of, you know, he's shedding his earlier roots of, he's shedding his earlier roots, but also not, because this is a lot of very animated slapstick and violence in it. But it's also done a lot more intelligently because, you know, it starts off and as David and Don Yippes did with their recreation, it's setting up the pretentious, you know, the pious Donald, you know, that we know and love in these Bark stories. And, you know, he's like, we're going to prove a point, you know, by annoying everybody in town with caroling.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be the setup. It's basically just a story about Donald wanting to appreciate the season by caroling.
Mm-hmm.
and I'll tell you that the thing that struck me right away is the writing in this one. Barks is a great writer, but this one is like superlative.
Yes,
every word, every phrase, every turn is so funny and so precisely written. Mm-hmm. It is just a hoot. I'm not going to read a lot of this out loud, but there's a lot of this that just really begs to be read out loud. And just reading the text here is cracking. So we're going to do it. Let's kind of go through the action of the story and talk, you know, share our comments. Basically, as we said, the setup is that Donald is like bum rushing his nephews out of the house to do some caroling, some good old fashioned caroling. And you know, this is like, what, 70 years ago now? Mm-hmm. But even then, it's being coded as old fashioned, right? The nephews are like, what are you talking about? People don't want strangers bellowing on their doorsteps. They get better stuff on phonograph records. Right. So I like that element. You know, it's supposed to feel kind of modern, contrast between modern and traditional.
But, and he's getting inspired by, you know, all these old fashioned books. And I've always, what's always been in my brain was Pickens from Dickens.
That is so funny. Yeah. Even the bookend, his funny bookend on that panel, it says antebellum bromides.
Oh God. Yeah.
What? That is so funny. I love it. And I love every reaction, the reactions of the nephews. I've got a sore throat, a hoarse frog. I'm coming down to the lame back. So anyway, they're going to get to their first customers, and all of the images of the duck sing. First off, it is silent night every time. It shows this is a good opportunity with the ducks, right? They've got their bills open like 170 degrees to do the singing. And Thad, my day job is as a speech pathologist. I'm mm-hmm. a speech therapist. So I'm like fascinated by when people transliterate stuff, you know, writing down how something is pronounced. The way that Barks transliterates in the original English, how the song is sung, just mm-hmm. cracks me the hell up.
Oh yeah, they're terrible singers. It's emphasized by the drawing as well as the word balloon in the dialogue. It's just you know, it's to set it up. It's like, yeah, we're gonna do this wonderful favor for the world, but we're terrible and just irritating everyone.
And so every stop, it's very predictable, but I don't mind the predictability of this one because it's just so fun to see it play out. And the character art is so good. You know, at the first one, Donald gets a boot smacked into his face. At the second one, oh my God, I am going to read this bit of dialogue here, right? So it's transliterated as silent nyut. Holy Nyut. And there's a blanching cat in the background. There's a word balloon of a little kid saying, "What's out there, Papa? Banshees?" Mm-hmm. And the homeowner says, "Great Scott, those sounds come living beings." I love it.
And he sicks the sprinkler on them because he's, I've been wondering if my sprinkler system is frozen up. This is a good time to find it.
Right.
And, you know, he soaks them with freezing water. And Donald, of course, is more determined than ever. And who should he pick to sing? Oh, Neighbor Jones. That's a great idea. And the nephews, of course, say, if we sing for that old sourpuss, it'll be from a safe distance. It's predictable results. Donald tries to sing, and immediately he gets a typical Jones response. He gets hit with a soulful carols book, and Jones says, "Okay, keep it silent."
Yeah,
and it's what's fascinating with this one is that a couple of the poses look like Barks actually referenced the story when he remade it as the terrible tourist, because when Donald's being accosted by the guy in that story, it's they're right down to the letter, like the same type of posing. So I don't think artists, even as great as Barks is, would have remembered that exactly. So I think he did dig into his files and found that story.
Right. And definitely the era where he did like to, you know, he was experiencing a little bit of burnout, so he liked to repurpose mm-hmm. his stuff here and there. We haven't even remarked on the fact that we got Neighbor Jones here. This is one of only, is it six times that Barks used, quote, the real Neighbor Jones?
Yes. That's one of very few times, which makes its obscurity even more tragic, because I think it might be the funniest one.
Yeah. I agree. It blows my mind that I went until like this week before I read what has got to be the best Barks take on Neighbor Jones. So, you know, the rest of the story is going to be taken up by his encounter with Jones. And Donald's just going to get more and more stubborn. Jones, we don't see a lot of him for a lot of story, right? It's mostly his hands, like, throwing implements at him up until we kind of get his reveal, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he shoves Donald's accordion. We should also say that he's using an accordion, and to add to the insult of singing, he's playing badly too. And
right.
Jones shoves it down his throat. And say, I always thought these things make good tire pumps, and throws him off on his merry way, bouncing out.
And look at that. We're into our first non-Firestone story, and we've got an actual reference to a tire here.
Yes.
And yeah, I love how he transliterates Donald now with the accordion down his throat. I get it, Thad. This is pretty mean-spirited. This is pretty violent, but it's just a riot. It's so funny. He's gonna shoot an arrow with a brick attached to it at him, and Donald's just escalating and escalating. At this point, he can't give up, can't do the thing that he should do and walk away, unlike the nephews who knew. So he's gonna escalate with a megaphone. And you know, I like this part where Jones says he's gonna have to get tough, and he jumps Donald. What is it? So Thad, you're a big classic cartoons guy, right? Why don't you tell us about this moment here? Because I feel like the kids these days don't know how important Alum was in 30s, 40s, and thereabouts.
Okay, so Alum, it fixes dye to cotton and other fabrics, rendering the dye insoluble. It's also used in pickling, in baking powder, in fire extinguishers, and as astringents in medicine. And that is where a lot of cartoonists would like to use it, you know, the pickling specifically, shriveling it up. And and a great many Warner and MGM cartoons used alum to great comical effect. There's a couple, like long-haired hare, where Bugs Bunny does the same thing to Giovanni Jones, and it shrinks his head. And it's actually interesting Barks used this, because normally you do not think of Barks as being of that broad, you know, quote-unquote cartooniness. And he's using it as, you know, some, like, Tex Avery did a Screwy Squirrel cartoon, Lonesome Lenny, with Alum in it, with the same type of results around the same time as the story. So it's just interesting that Barks is using something, like, as I said, this broad, that someone like Tex Avery would use it. And, you know, Donald's determined. He has the predictable results that we've seen Sylvester the cat sometimes have, with his mouth shriveled up and he can't eat Tweety. But he's still determined. He gets a surplus of all the old radio speakers from the nephew's toy broadcasting system and a microphone, and he breaks and enters Jones's house to plant radios all over. And since he can't sing, he forces the nephews to sing into the microphone. And this is just a beautiful page and a half. You don't see the ducks at all, except in silhouette at one point. And Jones is just destroying his house, trying to find the source of the singing. He's like, the nerve of that duck coming right into my house to sing. And that mad monster planted a loudspeaker in my floor. And, you know, they're coming through in more and more unpredictable places. And, you know, there's a nice little silhouette of Donald listening in on the noise. Jones is going crazy in there. Sounds like he's tearing the whole house apart, which exactly is what he did. Merry Christmas, Jones. Driving.
Yeah, I know. He's kind of breaking and entering on Christmas, right?
Yes. It's wonderful. Jones is getting more and more flustered and deranged about, you know, where is this coming from? And he's like, I've torn out 10 loudspeakers. There can't be any more. There just can't. And out of the shower comes Silent Night, Holy Night.
Yeah, it really escalates just perfectly. And again, what it doesn't work with any others. It doesn't work nearly as well. You know, Thad, if I read this in dim light, this part, this sequence with Jones, you could have told me that this was like drawn by William Van Horn. It has that like
swoopy. It's very.
I feel like this is almost a character study of what he took, you know, where he wanted to go with Barks, with his art.
Well, it's probably the most Barks ever drew of the character. And as I said, this is such a broader story that, you know, just a cartoonist like Van Horn would just latch onto these poses. And they're all wonderful and very funny.
Yeah, and boy, if we thought that this was violent and mean-spirited, but hilarious,
it keeps going.
Up till now, yeah. Jones is going to strike back. He's decided if he can't stop his singing, he'll get him to wear himself out singing to someone else. So he uses some gargle to fix him up so he can sing again. And then he's going to take him to go caroling to a friend of his out in the distance, much to the nephew's, you know, they're warning him that.
Yeah, don't trust him. This is a bad idea. But Donald's ego is just... he thinks he's won and he's just not seeing sense. And of course, Jones says, I've got a sick friend up the canyon that needs cheering up. Will you sing him a carol, Ducky Boy? And they go off. And
I love that they're Ducky Boy and Jonesy now.
Yes. And they go off. Into the distance 10 minutes later, and it's just this lone little cabin on a mountain in the distance. It's like, he's like, how are we gonna get there? It's like, we don't, you sing from here. It's half a mile across the canyon and I have to sing against the wind. And he's got an electrified baton. It's really a cattle prod.
It's a cattle prod.
And he's just zapping Donald to scream across to the mountain. And, you know, it just ends beautifully with him still him sitting like a statue, prodding Donald's behind while he's screaming the song and in pain and louder, louder. I forgot to tell you that besides being sick, my friend is stone deaf. Louder. You know, it's just, that's one of those Barks lines that's been burnt into my brain ever since I read it. And yeah, it's a shame you haven't read it till now, but it makes for interesting fodder that like you read it. And, you know, I don't know, Mark, has this like skyrocketed to your favorite winter and Christmas bark stories?
I mean, you know, it hasn't had enough season the way that stories need to become a longtime favorite. But right. But I will say that this has just immediately jumped up somewhere into the contender for certainly not like top 10 or anything, but this is poking around in, I think, the 10% of his.
Well, I think with the holiday stories, absolutely. Of anything holiday wise, I mean, you know, you want to go for the sentimentality sometimes, but this is just a really funny story. It's paced perfectly. Everything builds, you know, it's all the poses are really funny. I mean, you know, you've got this impending doom on the last page before you see it. You just see that mountainside cabin. I was like, oh, what's this about? And, you know, it's just, you know, if I had to say, like, I could see their point of view, the Western editors. It's a very, it's not the type of thing you'd want in the Christmas issue of Walt Disney's Comics and Stories, maybe. I would think that the main objection, even though they haven't flat out said it, I think they would be very nervous about claims from concerned parents that this is sacrilegious because they are singing a hymn. But fortunately, it survived. I mean, this would be really tragic if it was completely lost.
Absolutely.
You know, there's at least one or two other stories where, you know, you had, well, there's a bunch of stories that went off of Barks's memory or notes, and it's like, and it's, and those are fun to see, but it's like, I can't imagine anyone being able to recreate this. Maybe William Van Horn and the combo of Van Horn and John Lustig, but I mean, like, this is literally the genuine article, and
yeah,
it's just wonderful to have this. It's a real lost gem of a story.
Yeah, you know, and it came out around the same time as the Milkman story, right? They were the kind of late reprinted ones.
Yes,
they came, the later print ones, which also had kind of a mean-spirited ending. But that's another like favorite of mine. I think it was.
It's a fun story. Like that.
Not as great as this one. Like no. I instantly. So you know, I'll tell you, I'm thinking about it right now, Thad. I won't get into my like specific religious whatever, but up in terms of upbringing, I've been to a few Christmas Eve services, and mm-hmm. like this is the song that you sing.
Right.
You
oh,
sing
of course.
This me reverently too. Oh, yeah. Holding the candle. So I get it. I don't agree with it. I say print it anyway, you cowards. But yes. I, of course I can say that easily. Like, but I get it. That's certainly got to be the big part of the reason why. It was
and a different era. Which you know, it's kind of funny. It's in reverse. It's okay now. And so, you know, there's not a lot of 1945, 46 media where you could say, you know, it's like more appropriate today than it was then. So yeah. You know, that shows. What an advanced level Barks was operating at.
Right. And I'll tell you, there's almost too many great panels here to just really mm-hmm. pull out. But there's a really modest one that I just keep coming back to. And it's around the last page where the last panel with the nephews going, it just seems so where the nephews appear. In retrospect, when you think about what happened to the story, they say, this will be too terrible to watch. You said it. Let's go home and hit the hay. So, like, at that point, Barks himself had to, like, remove the kids.
Yes.
Because it genuinely was, you couldn't have done that last panel with their uncle getting cattle prodded with them present there. And it would end up being too terrible to print, at least, mm-hmm. you know, initially. It would see the light. Any of the many, many great panels that you would like to call out for this?
You know, I said that whole page of and a half of Jones destroying his house. It's just too wonderful, you know, to single out any panel. But, you know, that final panel is still burnt into my brain. Just the beautiful use of the silhouette of Donald Payne and Jones very indifferent to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that one is awesome. So let's check in on Index. So Thad, for the Index rating, it's ranked well, right? It's number 511.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, it's a 7.3. I have my own little list of 10 pagers. So if you just pluck out the 10 pagers, I can tell you that it makes his 29th percentile for all of those. So it's in the top third, you know.
That's good.
My instinct is to say that this is actually like deserves to be even higher. I loved this so much from the first read.
I don't know where exactly it would rank, but it would probably be in my top 10 of the 40s, 10 pagers at least, because if you're doing overall, it's going to be so dominant with the early 50s stories. But if you just singled out the 40s, I mean, this one's there.
Yeah, I'm going to say that just my snap reaction is that this is the second best one that I've read after The Duck and the Iron Pan is my favorite.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go.
Yeah. So far. So, just a really great little holiday treat. It was really great to talk about. What a cool thing. I don't always get to cover it. It's almost like I covered it because I read it so recently. Did you have any other comments about this or any of the other stories before we wrap things up?
I do not, but I'm just very grateful and thrilled that you wanted to do my suggestion of Silent Night. So, and you had the good idea of combining it with the giveaways because they're all from the same era, the same couple of years. And I hope that if anyone like Mark has not read this story, please seek it out. It's hysterical.
Yeah, well said. And thank you for, it was an ace's suggestion. So perfect. Well, Thad Komorowski, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
People can check you out on, I know that you're always at work restoring, restoring those old cartoons. Anything you feel like plugging?
Nothing at the moment. I'm just too dang busy. Like Karl Barks himself, I'm always working, but that's when I can be happiest, but
yeah. Excellent. Well, so I will just mention that Barks Remarks can be found on the usual places, mostly on Facebook, sometimes on Instagram. This has been what I call a 10-page podcast episode. So, you know, we'll be back with a regular episode soon. And just happy holidays. I'll call out Christmas because, of course, these are Christmas stories. So Merry Christmas to you, Thad, but happy whatever holidays you and any of the listeners celebrate.
Likewise to you, Mark. Thanks so much.